the following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Rendell.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Trump is apparently so freaked out by Omarosa's secret tapes that now he wants Omarosa in jail. Vanity Fair reported today that Trump told advisors he wants Attorney General Jeff Sessions to have Manigault Newman arrested. It's unclear what law Trump believes she broke. You think you can arrest Omarosa? This is a person you tried to fire four times and you still can't get rid of her. If you threw Omarosa in jail, she would tunnel her way out with a spoon Shawshank style. And then when you woke up the next morning, she's going to be standing over your bed with a copy of the Russian pee tape. This isn't the first time Trump's tried to silence Omarosa. After she was fired from the White House, the Trump team tried a tactic with her that they've tried with several former Trump aides, giving her a job on the campaign to keep her quiet. Remember, this is a person who Trump has called wacky, deranged, vicious, and not smart. But apparently he wanted to hire her a fifth time.
Manigault Newman says she was subsequently offered a $15,000 a month job on the Trump campaign that would, of course, require that she keep quiet about her time in the Trump administration.
You're a crazy lowlife who can't be trusted. Welcome aboard.
Omarosa was offered the job. She was offered the job on the campaign by Lara Trump, Eric Trump's wife, who's an official with the Trump campaign. Omarosa says she took it as an attempt to buy her silence. And once again, she had a secret tape to back up her story. This was a conversation Omarosa had with Lara Trump shortly after being fired from the White House.
It sounds a little like, obviously, that there's something you got in the back pocket to pull out. Clearly, if you come over at the campaign, like, we can't have, we gotta...
Oh, God, no. Everybody's
positive, right? So I know you were making 179 at the White House, and I think we could work something out where we keep you right along those lines. Specifically, let me see, I haven't even added up the numbers, but we were talking about like 15K a month. Let me see what that adds up to.
I'll take 15K a month.
Yeah, so that's 180,000. Does that sound like a fair deal for you?
Maybe next time you're offering someone hush money to keep them quiet, do the math before you get on the phone.
Yeah.
So let's see, 15K a month times 12, let's see. And we're going to carry the one. That's 180,000 a year, plus, of course, $5.99 for a roll of duct tape.
Ah.
So first they hired Omarosa, then they fired her, then they tried to hire her again to buy her off. This is how Trumpism works. Everyone is conning everyone else. And in the process, they're conning the rest of us, too. In fact, Trump's favorite TV show, Fox and Friends, basically admitted as much yesterday when, in a rare moment of honesty, they said that Omarosa had outplayed Trump.
The other big story yesterday was what's going on with Omarosa. In order to sell a book, she's come out with a series of tapes and in many ways seems to have outsmarted the president who's taken the bait and gone out and tweeted directly after her.
Wow. That's Trump's favorite TV show. That's the show he watches every morning to feel better about himself.
Oh, God.
That's like if you put on a meditation tape and it said, you're sitting by a mountain stream. Birds are singing. Every day that passes, you're closer to death.
Oh, nice.
But that's such a revealing clip because there's no better vessel of modern conservatism than Fox and Friends. And even they're telling you that it's all just a giant grift. Omarosa is playing Trump. Trump is playing the rest of us. And Rudy Giuliani is just a
butthead.
He's the butthead. That was Senator, what's his name? Kennedy from Louisiana, who said he's a butthead. All right. Welcome to a Friday. That was Seth Meyers with a little bit of comedy to get us started on the day. And I'm bummed because I found out this morning that Stephen Colbert is going on vacation for 2 weeks. Now, we get a lot of our, you know, start the show off with a laugh bits from Colbert. So I'm going to have to do some more digging. I know Jimmy Kimmel's pretty funny. Not really into Fallon that much these days. I know he's trying to get on the go after Trump bandwagon, but too little too late, I think. Seth Meyers is funny, often long-winded, but I'm going to try to keep up with our a comedy bit to start every show to get us off on a laughing foot before we get to all the depressing news of the day for the next 2 weeks. Okay? All right. We'll try. Anyway, so Samantha Bee clips. Yep, we can use Samantha Bee. And actually, I haven't found them online, but I'll tell you, one of the funniest TV comedy shows that's on, it's a weekly show. It's on Comedy Central, and I think it's on, I want to say Tuesday nights. Jim Jefferies, you know, he's the Australian comedian. His show is the best of all of them. It really is. It's only a half hour, but it's really, I mean, usually spot on and very, very funny. So on Comedy Central, I highly recommend it. All right. Today, we are going to tackle an important subject. It's one that there's a lot of controversy about because there is a big difference of opinions, even among Democratic circles, as to whether or not Democrats should be going after Donald Trump to impeach him or not. You know, there's the Nancy Pelosi arm of the party who says no, because she's always got her reasons. I mean, remember, she was the one who famously took impeachment of George W. Bush off the table when he should have rightly been impeached before she even became speaker, before the table was even set. She took impeachment off the table. And she seems to be doing that again. There is some trepidation amongst some Democrats that if we, you know, were to go full blown into impeachment talk right now, that would what's the word I'm looking for? It's Friday. I'm so ready for a rest. That would motivate Republicans, Trump supporters, to come out in bigger numbers to protect him. So maybe, you know, maybe we don't tip our hands publicly, but we, you know, we still go through not just the motions, but the procedures necessary to be ready to look into impeachment, to investigate what a new book has laid out are 8 areas in which Donald Trump has committed impeachable offenses. The book is called The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. Holding it up here, I'm about halfway through with it, and it's a fast-reading book. And what they do is, like I said, they lay out 8 different areas. 1, accepting unconstitutional foreign and domestic emoluments. That's a word we've all become very familiar with over the last 2 years. 2, conspiring to solicit and then conceal illegal foreign assistance for his presidential campaign. Yeah. 3, obstructing justice. 4, directing law enforcement to investigate and prosecute political adversaries and critics for improper purposes. There's some of that going on right now. 5, abusing the pardon power. Yeah. 6, advocating illegal violence and undermining equal protection of the laws. Yeah. 7, reckless endangerment by threatening nuclear war. See, these are all happening. And 8, undermining the freedom of the press. And then there's 9, potential additional grounds. And there are other additional grounds. And who we're going to be talking with, the book is written by 3 constitutional lawyers who are all part of Free Speech for People, a great organization. You can find it at freespeechforpeople.org. And Ron Fine, John Bonifaz, and Ben Clements. Ron Fine is going to join us at the bottom of the hour. We'll go through all of the things that Trump could be impeached for right now. Their whole premise is there's lots of stuff he's doing, and we don't have to wait for Mueller's investigation to be over. We could get the ball rolling now. So let's. Okay. Before we get to what's news, there's one other thing I want to play for you, because I meant to play it yesterday, and I ran out of time. So if you're watching on YouTube, you'll see a video. Hopefully I won't get copyright violated for playing this. But otherwise, you'll hear the audio. And what you'll hear is going back and forth between Fox Business Channel and one of their blonde bimbos by the name of Trish Regan, I think is her name. She went off the other day bad-mouthing Denmark and that country's form of socialism and equating it to Venezuela. And, one has nothing to do with the other, just in case you were wondering. So I'm going to play this video for you because it's pretty stunning. People in Denmark got wind of the comments that were made, and they fought back. So here's what Denmark came up with to push back against Fox's Trish Regan. Take it away, video.
In Denmark.
Fox News host Trish Regan has made a story in which she compares Denmark to Venezuela.
Denmark, like Venezuela, has stripped people of their opportunities.
Okay, let's just clarify a few things. Trish, you're wrong. You can't compare Denmark to Venezuela. We have a welfare state in our country. This means that our society provides opportunity for people. It doesn't strip people of possibilities in their life.
And no one wants to work. This is a real problem.
This is not true. According to the OECD, Denmark rates 11 places higher than the US unemployment rate. The difference, of course, being that in Denmark, people are paid a decent wage.
School's free. University's free. That's lovely.
Actually, it is.
But you see, not only is school free, they actually pay you. Not bad, eh?
That is not bad. That means that it's not the size of your parents' bank account that decides whether or not you get an education. It's your hard work, it's your talent, it's your motivation.
Well, you know what happens then? Nobody graduates from school, they just stay in school.
Oy. Of course people graduate. According to World Economic Forum, on a list of the best educated populations, we rank number 6. Quite a bit better than
nice.
The US. Sorry.
Nowadays, all the kids graduating from school in Denmark, they want to start cupcake cafes.
I wish that was correct because I love cupcakes. Unfortunately, it's not. It could be, though, because according to Forbes' list over countries with best opportunities for businesses, Denmark rates far better than the US. So,
yep.
Trish, pretty much everything you said is untrue, or as your beloved president would put it,
you are fake news.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. 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 Ah, sorry about that. Brilliant pushback from Denmark to Fox Noise, because that's all it is. Yeah. And Robert Hill in the chat room says, sad to say, the faux viewers will buy her BS without questioning it. Well, hopefully some of them will see that. I'd love to live in a place like Denmark. Might be a little too cold for me. You know, I'm used to Florida winters and all that. But Denmark, it always comes out in terms of the World Happiness Index. They're always at the top of the list because people are happy. Yes, they pay higher taxes, but they get everything covered with that. Healthcare, education, their commons are taken care of. It's not like here where, you know, everything is crumbling and as of this time next year, most of us will likely be uninsured again. People like me, those of us on Obamacare. Anyway, I digress. So I wanted to share that with you. Once again, Fox misinformed, and thank you to the people of Denmark for setting the record straight. There is a lot of news of the day, so let's just launch into today's What's News, shall we?
I read the news today.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Well, a dozen of the nation's former intelligence officials have slammed Donald Trump's decision to revoke former CIA Director John Brennan's security clearance, claiming that the president is trying to stifle free speech. MSNBC's Willie Geist has that story.
Some new reporting from the Washington Post that President Trump feels emboldened by stripping ex-CIA Director John Brennan of his security
Amazing.
Clearance. Trump believes he's emerged looking strong and decisive in his escalating feud with Brennan, two aides are telling the Post, adding The president shows a visceral disdain for the former CIA director when he sees him on television. White House officials say Trump did not focus on his power to remove clearances until this summer. White House aides confirm that Trump made his decision weeks ago about Brennan, who serves as an NBC News contributor. Senior advisors, including Press Secretary Sarah Sanders, recommended to the president that they announce the action Wednesday amid the onslaught of news coverage about former aide Omarosa Manigault Newman's new book, which accuses President Trump of having made racist remarks, among other things. CIA Director Gina Haspel is remaining silent about the treatment of her predecessor. Asked if Haspel approved of Trump stripping Brennan of his security clearance, and if she'd known about it or advised the president on the issue in advance, CIA spokesman Tim Barrett told the Daily Beast only, CIA does not comment on individual security clearances. But 12 former top intel officials, including CIA directors Webster, Tenet, Goss, Hayden, Panetta, and Petraeus, signed a letter that states this: "We feel compelled to respond in the wake of the ill-considered and unprecedented remarks and actions by the White House regarding the removal of John Brennan's security clearances." Amazing. It goes on: "We all agree that the president's action regarding Brennan and the threats of similar action against other former officials has nothing to do with who should and who should not hold security clearances, and everything to do with an attempt to stifle free speech. You don't have to agree with what Brennan says," the letter goes on, "and again, not all of us do, to agree with his right to say it, subject to his obligation to protect classified information." This comes after former Navy Admiral William McRaven, who oversaw the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, wrote a public letter challenging the president to revoke his security clearance. McRaven writes that Brennan is one of the finest public servants I've ever known. Few Americans have done more to protect this country than John. Therefore, I would consider it an honor if you would revoke my security clearance as well, so I can add my name to the list of men and women who have spoken up against your presidency. If you think for a moment that your McCarthy-era tactics will suppress the voices of criticism, you are sadly mistaken. The criticism will continue until you become the leader we prayed you would be." Again, that's from Admiral McRaven, directed at the President of the United States.
The whole letter was pretty brilliant. Willie Geist read most of it there. This is a great show of solidarity, I guess, from a bipartisan group of former intelligence officials who are all saying this is bullshit. You know, in a word. The Washington Post is reporting that Trump has told advisors that he is eager to strip more security clearances as part of an escalating attack against people who have criticized him or played a role in the investigation of alleged Russian interference in the 2016 presidential campaign. Going back to this book on The Constitution Demands It, this falls under potential additional grounds, I think, for impeachment. Yes, we will get to that. Shortly before noon today, Donald Trump was leaving the White House to make an appearance in Southampton, New York, before heading back to his Bedminster, New Jersey golf club again for the weekend. Yeah, he just returned from a 10-day vacation there, and he's going back again for the weekend, costing us how much money? It's a rhetorical question. But he took some questions from the press about revoking former intelligence officials' clearance, beginning with John Brennan.
There's no silence. If anything, I'm giving him a bigger voice. Many people don't even know who he is, and now he has a bigger voice. And that's okay with me because I like taking on voices like that.
Oh, God.
I've never respected him. I've never had a lot of respect.
He's talking about Brennan.
And Senator Burr said it best. If you knew anything, why didn't you report it when you were before all of these committees, including their committee? So he had a chance to report. He never did. This was just came up lately, and it's a disgusting thing, frankly.
You know, you're a disgusting thing, frankly.
I say it again. That whole situation is a rigged witch hunt. It's a totally rigged deal. They should be looking at the other side. They should be looking at all the people that got fired by them. All of the people that got fired, they should be looking at Bruce Orr and his wife, Nellie, for dealing with, by the way, indirectly Russians. They should be looking at Steele. They should be looking at all these FBI guys who got fired and demoted. It's a really weird, it's not us. It is a
not you?
Witch hunt. I've said it for a long
oh,
time.
God.
Say it. I think Bruce Orr is a disgrace. I suspect I'll be taking it away very quickly. I think that Bruce Orr is a disgrace with his wife, Nellie. For him to be in the Justice Department and to be doing what he did, that is a disgrace. That is disqualifying for Mueller. And Mr. Mueller has a lot of conflicts also, directly yourself, so you know that. Mr. Mueller is highly conflicted.
Oh, really?
In fact, Comey is like his best friend.
No, that's a lie.
I can go into conflict after conflict.
And lie and lie
and
lie.
Mr. Mueller is conflicted. But let him write his report. We did nothing. There's no collusion. But if he was doing an honest report, he'd write it on the other side. Because when you look at criminality and you look at problems, take a look at what they did, including colluding with the Russians, the other side.
The other side. No, it's pretty much your side. He's just delusional. Just hours after a CNBC report yesterday saying that Trump's military parade planned for November 10th was estimated to cost $92 million, that's $80 million more than initially estimated, the Pentagon announced that the parade had been postponed until 2019, which is only a good thing because it gives us more time to get rid of him first. Trump took to Twitter this morning to blame Washington, D.C. elected officials for jacking up the price tag for the parade, forcing him to cancel it. So now he says he'll spend Armistice Day in France enjoying their parade again. I have a few things I could say here, but I'll leave it to your imagination. Oh, moving right along. Jurors in the trial of former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort ended their first day of deliberations yesterday by asking the judge a set of questions regarding the defense, including asking for a definition of what reasonable doubt means. Here's CNN's report.
After almost 7 hours of deliberations, the jury knocked on the door. The court security officer went in, came out with a piece of paper. And it turns out the jury has four questions. One of them relates to the requirement to file notice that Manafort had foreign bank accounts. They asked very specific questions related to the elements of that charge. They also asked a question about what is required for Manafort on some of the tax charges he faces. They asked the judge also for a definition of reasonable doubt, and then another question, they wanted some help indexing the exhibits to the indictments. Now, the judge told the jury, he called them back in, he told them that they had to rely on their recollection for all of these counts, all these questions that they had, but he did tell them for reasonable doubt, he told them that it did not mean beyond possible doubt.
Hmm.
So that was the only real affirmative instruction that the judge gave to the jury. And the jury notified the judge they were going to break today at 5:30 and they'll return tomorrow morning and pick up deliberations where they left off. But they're not getting any real additional information. The judge is telling them they need to rely on their memory and they need to rely on the testimony of the witnesses and the documents that they have as exhibits.
And apparently today they've been negotiating nonstop. I don't think there have been any more questions from the jury room. Still no verdict, but they're deliberating on 18 separate counts. So this could go on for a while. Omarosa Manigault Newman yesterday unveiled a third secret recording, this one featuring Laura Trump, that's Eric's wife, discussing details of a job offer on the Trump campaign that would require the former White House aide to remain publicly positive about the president. And for this, and seemingly little else, she'd be paid $15,000 a month.
But listen, obviously with like the New York Times article and stuff, you know,
what's the New York Times article?
The one that it was in the New York Times today. I guess you did with Maggie Haberman, or they wrote about you. It sounds a little like, obviously, that there's something you've got in the back pocket to pull out. Clearly, if you come over at the campaign, like, we can't have, we gotta, everybody's positive, right? So the only thing that we have to consider when we're talking salary, as far as the campaign is concerned, is that, as you know, everything is public. And all the money that we raise and that pays salaries is directly from donors, small dollar donors for the most part. So I know you were making $179 at the White House.
Unbelievable.
And I think we could work something out where we keep you right along those lines. Specifically, let me see, I haven't even added up the numbers, but we were talking about like $15K a month. Let me see what that adds up to.
To shut her up.
Yeah, so that's $180,000. Does that sound like a fair deal for you? In terms of your position specifically, I really feel like your position would require, you know, you to be able to be flexible in terms of where you are. Sometimes, you know, come to New York for occasional meetings, but I would love if you could, you know, occasionally go do speaking engagements and that sort of thing for us. I think you'd be awesome doing that. And so it doesn't really matter where you are. If you're comfortable staying in D.C.,
doesn't matter.
Then, you know, we're more than happy to have you.
And it cuts off there. Yeah. I guess she got offered more than $180,000 for an advance on this book. The publisher, let's see. According to the New York Times, Omarosa may have as many as 200 tapes. This could be a very long October surprise, depending on what's in those tapes. The publisher behind her new book has dismissed what they call hollow threats by Trump's lawyers, saying being embarrassed by a book does not amount to a legal claim. This is going to drag on for a while, especially if she's got 200 tapes. 3 weeks after the deadline to reunite families separated at the border, a total of 565 migrant children, including 24 who are younger than 5 years old, remain in government-contracted shelters, still separated from their parents. This according to a status update from the Trump administration. All I'm asking you is for a little respect when you come home. Just a little bit, baby, baby, just a little bit. Ah, the undisputed queen of soul, Aretha Franklin, died yesterday after a battle with pancreatic cancer. Tributes to Aretha dominated the airwaves throughout the day. I was actually pleasantly surprised with how much time CNN and MSNBC gave Aretha. Fox News honored the life and career of the late Aretha Franklin with an image of singer Patti LaBelle. They then flubbed the apology by lying about the mix-up, saying that they were trying to show a picture of Aretha and Patti LaBelle singing together at an event in D.C. They never sang together. In fact, there was a little bit of bad blood between the two of them. So it was just a lie. Fox, you know, all those people look alike. And that's a bit of what's news for now. I just had to say it. It's if it's true, you know, it's looking you right in the eye. We'll take a quick break and come back on the other side with Ron Fine, one of the authors of The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. It's the Nicole Sandler Show at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Biggest war today. I'll tell you, today on Hightower's Radio Lowdown. America's political history has been written in the fierce narrative of war. Not our country's many military clashes with foreign nations, but our own unending war for democracy in the USA. Generation after generation of moneyed elites have persisted in trying to take wealth and power from the workaday majority and concentrate both in their own hands to establish a de facto American aristocracy. Every time, the people have rebelled and organized mass struggles against the monopolists and financial royalists, literally battling for a little more economic fairness, social justice, and equal opportunity. And now, the time of rebellion is upon us again, for we the people are suddenly in the grip of a brutish level of monopolistic power. Corporate concentration of markets, profits, workplace decision-making, political influence, and our nation's total wealth is surpassing that of the infamous era of robber barons. Apple, which just recently became the first U.S. corporation to reach a stock value of $1 trillion, is now larger than Bank of America, Boeing, Disney, Ford, Volkswagen, and 20 other brand-name giants combined. And the powerful tech industry is now controlled by just 5 superpowers, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Google, and Netflix, which raked in half of this year's stock price gains by the 500 largest corporations. Indeed, the recent gold rush of corporate mergers has created mega firms, shriveling competition in most industries: airlines, banks, drug companies, food, hospitals, hotels, law firms, media, oil, etc. Fewer and bigger corporations mean that those few attain overwhelming power over the rest of us. They're able to control workers' pay, jack up prices, dominate elections, and become even fewer, bigger, and more powerful. This is Jim Hightower saying it's an all-out corporate class war on the American people, and they're winning.
Need an antidote to the progressive blues? Want some good news about how grassroots folks are rebelling against the corporate powers and winning? Well, here's an easy-to-swallow pill for you. the Hightower Lowdown. Hightower's monthly newsletter will give you the lowdown, even as it lifts you up. It's 4 pages a month, jam-packed with facts you can use, actions you can take, and Jim's own Texas humor, all for only $15 a year. To become a lowdowner, go to HightowerLowdown.org.
This is a huge, huge issue.
And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
Back, and I'm really excited to talk to our next guest. As I've been telling you throughout the show, there's a new book out. It's called The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. It's written by three constitutional lawyers who all work together at a wonderful organization called Free Speech for People. You can find them at freespeechforpeople.org. Ron Fine, John Bonifaz, and Ben Clements. And joining us on the line right now is Ron Fine. Ron, are you there?
Yeah, it's great to join you.
Well, it's great to have you here. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you all for writing this book. You know, a lot of people have been saying since the day he was elected that he's not that Donald Trump is not qualified to be the president of the United States, and we're wondering how long it would take until he did something that's of an impeachable offense. A lot of people are waiting on Robert Mueller's case to be finished, thinking that that's going to give the cause for any impeachment should it come, that Robert Mueller will lay out a case for us that all we have to do is sit back and wait. That's not what you're saying in this book, is it?
That's right. We wrote this book to help Americans understand why there's already enough evidence for Congress to begin impeachment hearings now. And we lay out the facts and the legal analysis for 8 different potential grounds for impeachment proceedings. But just as importantly, we clear up some common misunderstandings about impeachment, including that it all depends on what crimes Mueller decides to charge, mm-hmm. or even just that impeachment is about whether the president committed a crime. And of the 8 grounds that we've identified, 2 of them overlap with the Mueller investigation, and 6 don't at all. And we finally explain why Congress can and should move forward with impeachment hearings immediately and not wait for Mueller to complete his criminal investigation, which could take any amount of time.
Well, as a sort of on a dedication page, you have from the United States Constitution, Article 2, Section 4, the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Is high crimes and misdemeanors intentionally vague?
And so one of the most common misunderstandings about that phrase is that it requires a prosecutable crime. Mm. And the founders didn't make up that phrase out of nowhere. They borrowed it from British impeachment history, where the Parliament in England had impeached officials for hundreds of years for high crimes and misdemeanors, including things that we would not consider to be crimes for which somebody could be prosecuted or put into prison. And in fact, in the constitutional debates, the founders gave examples of impeachable offenses, some of which Trump has committed, and which weren't crimes then and aren't crimes now. So the high crimes and misdemeanors can include abuses of power, where mm-hmm. the president has a certain power, but then he abuses it in a way that goes beyond acceptable limits. And that may not be a crime, but it can be a high crime and misdemeanor.
Well, and you have one of those. Number 5, abusing the pardon power. I think most of us, sort of our eyebrows raised in disbelief. When he first used his pardon power, if I'm not mistaken, his first pardon was Joe Arpaio, right?
That's right. And it's a perfect example of how the president does have the power to pardon people who have been convicted of or even not even yet tried of federal crimes. But just because he has the power doesn't mean he can use it in any unlimited way. And we know this because, among other people, James Madison, the father of the Constitution, mm-hmm. said that if the president misused the pardon power, then that would be grounds for impeachment. And in the book, we lay out the case for why this particular pardon of Sheriff Joe Arpaio is a good example of how a president can misuse a pardon in a way that is an impeachable offense.
Right. And now we're in the midst of something that could be, I mean, he went on, he pardoned Scooter Libby out of the blue. Many thought he was trying to send a message to some people who may be witnesses in the Mueller probe to you know, tell them basically, just be careful, just stay with me and I'll pardon you. There's a lot of speculation now as the jury has the Paul Manafort case, the first Paul Manafort case, that he's not flipping and he's expecting a pardon. That could be certainly construed as abusing the pardon power, wouldn't it?
That's right, and it can fit under multiple categories because mm-hmm. that can also be a form of obstruction of justice mm-hmm. if the reason that he's issuing a pardon to someone like that is to prevent an investigation from getting too close to himself. I mean, there's no clear written line about when a pardon goes too far and exactly where the boundaries are. The Constitution didn't attempt to define those limits in advance. It entrusted it to Congress to make that decision, and that's why impeachment is partly legal and partly political. So what we do in the book is we make the case for why the pardons that he's already issued, starting with that of Joe Arpaio, are grounds for impeachment as abuse of the pardon power, and also look forward to, or I shouldn't say look forward to, that makes it sound like we'd be happy with it, but sort of anticipate mm-hmm. some of the pardons that he may issue in the near future, and why those would also fall into that category.
Right, and that's just one out of eight areas that you've identified. Each one has their own chapter, starting with the first one, which, as I'm reading this book, and by the way, it is fast reading. I sat down with it for an hour, and I'm like halfway through, and it's fascinating, and mostly because this is all stuff that we've been following for the last year and a half. And we've lived through, and you see all of the, you know, all of the things that he's done, sort of laid out here in easy to understand legal talk. So you don't have to be a lawyer to sift through the legalese, and showing why this constitutes an impeachable offense. The first one, accepting unconstitutional foreign and domestic emoluments. Well, many of us heard the word emoluments for the first time after Donald Trump was elected. But he's sure taking them, isn't he?
Yeah, and this is a provision of the Constitution that even a lot of lawyers had forgotten about, and that's partly because all presidents before Donald Trump had taken steps to make sure that they would not be violating it. Only Trump has decided to steamroll over it. But the Foreign Emoluments Clause of the Constitution prohibits any executive official, including the president, from taking money from foreign governments. And the Domestic Emoluments Clause of the Constitution only applies to the president. And what it says is that he gets his salary, and at the moment it's a very generous salary, but that he can't take any additional money from the federal government or, for that matter, from state governments beyond that salary. And because of Trump's businesses, both here in the United States and also abroad, mm-hmm. he does take money from foreign governments and from the U.S. government outside of his official salary. And he was warned between the election and the inauguration that he needed to take effective action to separate himself from his businesses, which other presidents have done, including some men of great wealth, or even Jimmy Carter famously had to sell a peanut farm in Georgia to avoid having any problems here. But Trump decided not to follow that advice, and so he was violating these provisions of the Constitution from the moment he took the oath of office.
So, but nobody's calling him on it. I mean, in a legal way. The way to call him on it would be to start an investigation into impeachable offenses. I mean, what would say? All right, I'm going to jump a little ahead here and say, as long as the Republicans control the House of Representatives, nothing will be done because it's the House where an impeachment proceedings begin. So we have to hope that in November the Democrats take back the House, then they can start. So that would be when he would be held accountable for violating the Emoluments Clause.
Well, I really want to lay the blame here at both parties.
Okay.
Because the Democratic Party leadership has also shushed down impeachment
talk.
Yes,
they
have. There have been a few bold members of the House, like Al Green, Brad Sherman, mm-hmm. Steve Cohen, Maxine Waters, who have defied the leadership, but the both parties' leadership in Congress has done everything possible to avoid this kind of discussion. And what happened was, I think at the beginning, a lot of people said, well, maybe we can find some other way of dealing with this that doesn't involve impeachment. And Trump learned very early on that if he was violating what, you know, a lot of people hadn't heard of the Emoluments Clauses, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean they're not important. The founders considered them to be essential safeguards against corruption. And Trump learned the lesson very early on that he could ignore those limits and Congress would basically do nothing. And so that set the stage for everything that followed.
Yeah, and now he just figures he can get away with anything, and he's continuing to. We're speaking with Ron Fein. He's one of the three authors of the new book, The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. He is a constitutional lawyer with freespeechforpeople.org. The second one, it seems like every time, you know, Trump goes on a Twitter rant, for the longest time, he would end it with no collusion, no collusion.
Right.
Well, and then they're going to great lengths to say to us that, well, collusion isn't even a crime. But we understand conspiracy is, and it's basically the same thing. Number two in your book is conspiring to solicit and then conceal illegal foreign assistance for his presidential campaign. This is one that definitely overlaps with the Mueller probe, right?
It does. And this is one where there are federal crimes involved.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also important to understand that impeachment is not a criminal proceeding, and it certainly can have an overlap with federal crimes, but they serve different purposes. The purpose of criminal punishment or criminal prosecution is to punish a wrongdoer for something that they've done and maybe put them in prison. The purpose of impeachment is to remove a dangerous official from office to protect the country from further harm. And what Mueller is looking at are, you know, specific federal criminal statutes, and we do go through them in this chapter of the book and lay out all the different ways in which Trump could be criminally liable. But whatever Mueller decides that he thinks he can bring to a jury of, you know, 12 citizens of whichever district, you know, he may or may not choose to bring charges in and hope to get a unanimous jury verdict in a criminal case, Congress can step back and zoom out from the details of the specific criminal offenses and say the evidence indicates that the campaign for President of the United States, including the senior most campaign officials, was working actively to obtain foreign assistance in tilting the election, and this is certainly grounds for impeachment. Whatever Mueller does or doesn't decide to charge as a crime.
Wow. Numbers three and four sort of, I think, go together. Three is obstructing justice, and he's lately taken to saying no obstruction either. But there's plenty of instances of that. And then number four, directing law enforcement to investigate and prosecute political adversaries and critics for improper purposes. We're seeing this play out right now with him taking a security clearance away from former intelligence officials. Wouldn't that fall under that category?
Absolutely. And, you know, if I was finishing the book now, I'd include that as an example.
Mm-hmm.
What he's doing is he's using governmental power to punish people for criticizing him. And when the White House issued its original statement as to why he was pulling the security clearance for the former director of the CIA, it had this carefully written statement. It was largely nonsense, but it was mm-hmm. at least carefully written. But then he came right out and told the Wall Street Journal that he did it because the former CIA director was involved in the Russia investigation in the first place. So he's using his power both to prevent and block the investigation into himself and his associates, but also using government power to harass or go after in different ways political adversaries and critics.
It is stunning. Is there no, we're seeing him breaking all these rules, the norms of a president, of what the office of president does. Every day it seems like there's something different. And I would think it would be up to those in his party to try to tamp him down a little bit. We have a system of checks and balances, allegedly, in this country. Is it just that our system of checks and balances is failing because the majority party in Congress won't do anything to rein him back in?
It's not functioning, as you say, and I think the Republicans in Congress bear a lot of blame, but as I said, also the Democrats in Congress are also failing to hold up their end of it by not asking for things that maybe they could get at least some Republican support from. And what that means is that the system that the founders envisioned, in which Congress would be a check on the power of the president, is largely not working, and that the president is getting away with far more than anyone might have imagined. And, you know, some of it is out of the playbook of Nixon, mm-hmm. and some of it is stuff that even Nixon didn't imagine.
Right. Well, here we are, 40 years later, 50 years later. Number five, we talked about abusing the pardon power, and we we're in the foreshadowing mode of more of those pardons to come. Number six is advocating illegal violence and undermining equal protection of the laws. We're seeing that on a daily basis with the with people who are coming to this country for asylum. Right. And Donald Trump saying, who needs due process or something similar to that? Is that fall under that category?
Yeah. And this really goes back to his campaign where he was using a lot of this harsh rhetoric. But, a lot of people thought that when he assumed office that he would become, somehow stop this type of talk. But since entering office, he's urged police to be rough with suspects, basically
yep.
encouraging police brutality.
Mm-hmm.
He's given aid and comfort to neo-Nazis and
yep.
white supremacists
yes,
in
yeah.
Charlottesville. He suggested that the military should commit war crimes against Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
And, you might look at one statement and say, well, it's just one tweet or just one statement. He gave it a speech. But when you put it all together, it's a pattern that has a real effect. And sociologists have studied what they call the Trump effect, where Trump's words at his rallies and so forth actually have a measurable effect on incidents of violence and on racial incidents that you can actually track quantitatively. So he's actually undermining equal protection of the laws by the way that he is fomenting violence and racism.
Right, and he does. He incites violence. He's done it at his rallies since, during the campaign, and it continues the way he talks about people and, advocates for actually the wrong things. Let's see. Number seven, this is one we've been living through, reckless endangerment by threatening nuclear war. I was one of the people, I'm sure millions of us, horrified when I saw his original Twitter taunts to Kim Jong-un, about he's got a bigger button and fire and fury and everything else. That alone is an impeachable offense.
Yeah, and I think reckless endangerment is really a useful framework as a way of thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Reckless endangerment is a crime in many states. It's a crime in the military under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And, of course, Trump is the commander-in-chief of the military. And the essence of reckless endangerment is taking action that has a high risk of death or serious bodily harm with reckless or wanton disregard for that risk. And what's important about reckless endangerment is that it doesn't actually require that the harm actually come to pass as long as the person engaged in the reckless endangerment. And that's, an essential part of reckless endangerment is just making the reckless risk is the offense. And the way that Trump has erratically and recklessly toyed with or threatened nuclear war, some people say, well, maybe it's not so bad, but you could imagine a situation where you had a different president who was engaged in some kind of complicated three-dimensional chess where
mm-hmm.
he's, engaged in strategic gamesmanship and he's, making calculated diplomatic risks or something like that. But this is not Trump. I mean, his own national security advisor, his own secretary of state call him a moron or an idiot. And all evidence indicates that he doesn't understand or know about or even care about the risks of what he's doing. So when he issues these Twitter threats, he is taking on a serious risk that the leadership of North Korea or Iran or whatever other country will misunderstand or will react, and we could end up in a nuclear confrontation just because he got peeved on Twitter.
Yeah, that's a real fear. Obviously, it's had lots of people on edge. But so the reckless endangerment, that is in and of itself an impeachable offense, you're saying.
Yeah, we tell a story in the book about, just to give an example of what reckless endangerment can mean in a more day-to-day context, about a sergeant in the military who was convicted of reckless endangerment and sent to the brig because he failed to properly inspect parachutes. Unfortunately, nobody was harmed because somebody else discovered the reckless failure to do it. But it illustrates how this is a type of crime in that case that can, you know, result in somebody being sent to prison even if, you know, the harm doesn't come to pass. And I think that's an important point because some people say, well, we haven't had a nuclear war with North Korea. But he's taken actions that create the risk of that war, and he's done so recklessly. He's not been thoughtful about it, and nobody thinks that he's been thoughtful about it. And that's why this is a ground for impeachment, is to protect the country, to remove him from office before the next time he does it, it does result in a nuclear war.
Yeah, and that's a real fear, I mean, that I have, certainly. The last chapter on the eight cases you've laid out for impeachment now is, in my view, one of the most important, because this goes right to the First Amendment, undermining the freedom of the press. We have the freedom of the press enshrined in the First Amendment of the Constitution, and he has used Stalinistic language by calling the press the enemy of the people. He's incited violence against media personalities, against reporters. He uses the words of despots and dictators in vilifying the media for doing their jobs. This is really dangerous, but it is also an impeachable offense.
Yeah, and what's important to understand is that, and this is something that strongman leaders in other countries like Turkey or Venezuela have discovered, is that you don't need to engage in direct censorship in order to curtail the freedom of the press. You can undermine freedom of the press by more indirect ways, and that is what Trump has done. His constant harangues against the press as dishonest and fake news, undermining the credibility of the very concept of a free press, as well as using or trying to use, and not always being successful, but trying to use government power to threaten prosecution of reporters, to try and pressure companies to fire specific reporters. One case, he tried to raise the shipping rates on Amazon as an indirect way to punish the Washington Post. When you put all of these together, it adds up to a systematic campaign to undermine the freedom of the press. And just earlier this week, the U.S. Senate actually issued a resolution by unanimous consent decrying this and saying it's actually an attack on our democratic institutions, which I completely agree with, and it's endangered the freedom of the press more so than almost any action you could think of that a government official has taken within the last 100 years.
I couldn't agree more. He's threatened to take away the quote licenses of TV networks, which there is no such thing. I mean, individual stations are licensed. He shows how little he knows about how the press works in this country. He doesn't know what his limitations are, but he acts like a dictator who thinks he can do anything, like take away NBC's broadcast license.
Yeah, and you know, this is something that previous presidents, Democrat or Republican, have never tried with the extremity that Donald Trump is doing. And it's important to acknowledge that, of course, presidents are free to criticize the press or point out, you know, what they think is an inaccuracy in a news story. That's not what this is about. Mm-hmm. This is about a systemic effort to undermine the credibility and independence of the press, and therefore the freedom of the press under the First Amendment.
It's frightening. I mean, I remember back years ago, I used to worry about someone like Trump, someone who's so media savvy, getting in. And I would always point to Italy and say, you know, like Berlusconi controlled all the media. That's how he got elected. He who controls the media wins. And sure enough, Donald Trump has his own what is akin to state-run TV and Fox. I think we caught a lucky break with the FCC ruling against the Sinclair merger with Tribune, because that would have made an even bigger behemoth of just Trump television in what's already a really scary media climate.
Yeah, and when Trump has threatened or explored using the power of the Justice Department to favor certain networks or
yep.
media companies and to create problems for others based on their coverage, that begins to create it. It's not state-run TV in the way that, or newspapers or the way that Pravda would be in the Soviet Union, where it's literally run by the state, but it creates this idea that if you want to get your regulatory approvals, you have to toe a certain line.
Right.
And if you criticize the president, you're not going to be able to function as a business. And that takes us down the path that Russia, Venezuela, Turkey, and other countries that are descending out of democracy have taken, and that's a very dangerous territory.
It really, really is. Ron Fine is with us. We're talking about his new book, The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. And so you laid out those eight areas where you say the facts and law combine for the strongest cases for impeachment hearings at this point. But then you have in Chapter 9 potential additional grounds. And there's a lot of other stuff. I mean, I joke about the one thing that Trump was truthful about was when he said this.
The heads would spin. Your head will spin.
Your head will spin.
Your head will spin.
Because our heads are spinning. There's so much stuff going on every day. It's like they're throwing it all against the wall to see how to distract us from whatever we're, you know, now it's what'll distract us from the Omarosa thing. And that's when he decided to take away the security clearance or decided to release that, something that he'd been holding on to. But you have under this chapter everything from the Stormy Daniels matter to the Michael Cohen corporate slush fund, Ukrainian missiles. Other things that are bubbling, say, like under the surface that could also be grounds for impeachment, yes?
Yeah, and, you know, even as the book was going to press, we learned about the administration's efforts to break up migrant families and imprison the children in cages,
yep.
which courts have, you know, now specifically said is unconstitutional, and it's cruel and unusual punishment and violates due process. And in some cases, these families haven't violated any law whatsoever. In other cases, maybe the parents have committed a misdemeanor, but it, you know, far from justifies the treatment meted out to either them or certainly to their children. And there's no limit to what Trump may or may not try to do. And, you know, obviously the book, at some point we had to close the manuscript, but we knew that there would be more coming. And,
Every day.
Even as we're speaking with Brennan losing his security clearance, it's going to continue and it's going to get worse until he's stopped.
It's amazing. Your next chapter, Chapter 10, asks the question, why now? So I'll ask you, why now?
Well, you know, some people say that, you know, we should wait until Special Counsel Mueller figures out which crimes have been committed and by who and decides, you know, whether the president should be prosecuted for anything. But if you take that approach, what you're essentially saying is that everything else that we've identified doesn't matter.
Right.
It means that, you know, violating the emoluments clauses doesn't matter. Undermining the freedom of the press doesn't matter. Abusing the pardon power doesn't matter. And furthermore, you're putting a responsibility that the Constitution gave to Congress, which is elected by the people, and you're leaving it to a federal prosecutor. And I don't mean to say that in any way to criticize Mueller. He seems to be working very effectively, but he's working in the criminal justice system where there's certain limitations that are highly relevant and are necessary to protect the, you know, due process of the defendants and so forth, but have nothing to do with impeachment. The purpose of impeachment is to protect the country from an ongoing harm of a dangerous official. And every day that Trump stays in office is another dangerous day.
So what do we do now in the minute or so we have left? What can we do? Those of us who believe that it is time to impeach this man before so many of the things that we've talked about come to fruition, before he does start a nuclear war or do something else horrifically dangerous. What do we do now?
Well, after you've read this book, you'll understand the answer to the question of what has Trump done, and you'll be able to answer people who say that we don't have grounds for impeachment hearings yet. And then you'll be able to organize, mobilize, write letters to the editor, call your member of Congress, and get active in our democracy and make that demand.
There's a website set up, impeachmentproject.org. It's sort of as a companion website to the book. You can find some action you can take there. I highly recommend the book. It's easy reading, and you're going to be you won't want to put it down because this is the stuff we've been living through. Ron Fine, thanks to you and your co-authors John Bonifaz and Ben Clements. The Constitution Demands It: The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. Let's use this as a guidebook and get this done. Thank you so much, Ron. It was great talking with you.
Thank you for having me on.
My pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye. The book is available now. It just came out this week, or the 14th. Yes, it was released. So, do read it. And that does it for us for the week. Thank you for listening, everyone. Have a great weekend, and I'll see you back here on Tuesday.